This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, Edwina Farley with you. Thanks for joining me and the team for a trip around a big country. This week, we're taking a close look at native wattle trees. You might recognise their bright yellow flowers, but did you know the wattle seed is gaining favour as a food additive? It's said to taste a bit like chocolate, coffee and hazelnut. We'll hear about a project that turns ocean debris into works of art, find out what's involved in collecting fresh honey from bush hives, and go sniffing around the tea harvest.
My favourite smell of everything in here is the freshly picked green leaf. There's just so much going on in there. The aromas and fragrances that come out of the fresh leaf is pretty amazing. It's like a combination of every nice perfume and flower, along with the smell of a candy store. It's just so fresh and sweet.
Turning freshly picked fragrant tea leaves into the perfect brew, that's coming up. First though, to a harvest of a different kind. Wattle seed has been a mainstay of the diet of Indigenous Australians for thousands of years. Now it's becoming popular with top chefs and foodies, and growers are struggling to keep up with demand.
What we do is we spread tarpaulins down either side of the rows of trees, and then we use battery-powered olive rakes to go through and just rake the seed pods off the trees onto the tarps, and then we collect that up and store it in wool bales until I've got enough time to process it.
Mark Lucas is explaining the wattle seed harvest.
There's crushed-up seed pods, there's leaf, there's sticks, so I run it over a series of shaking machines with various size screens on it, and I can screen off the pods and the seeds in the first run, and then I change the screen size and run the seed over again, and that takes out all the little sticks and twigs, and then we're pretty much ready for roasting.
When you think of wattle, you probably picture the bright yellow flowers that appear on roadsides in spring. But did you know that once roasted, the wattle seed has a flavour that's been compared to coffee, chocolate and hazelnut? The native bush food has become highly sought after. But for Mark Lucas, growing wattle trees to harvest the seeds came about as a bit of an accident.
I was growing flowers for the Japanese flower market, and I had a couple of rows of wattle trees as windbreaks for the flowers. Japanese economy fell over and they were no longer importing flowers as it was a luxury item. So I pushed out my flowers and I was left with two rows of wattle trees. And a friend of mine pointed out that it's edible seed and is in demand for the bush foods industry. So I thought I'd better keep them, and I've actually planted up more since.
Hi, I'm Jessica Schremer. I'm here with Mark on his property in South Australia's Riverland, where he has about 2,000 wattle trees and is struggling to keep up with demand for the tree's tasty seeds.
Well, after we harvest it, we roast it and grind it like you would a coffee bean, and then that can be used as it is, as a powder. But then we take it a step further and we extract the flavour out of it, so it ends up like a vanilla extract, but it's a wattle seed extract.
And what do you use it for?
Okay, well at the moment the main use is in a wattle seed dark ale beer that the brewery up the road does. But it can be used in anywhere in cooking and baking. So wherever vanilla's called for in a recipe, you can drop your vanilla in the bin and go Aussie. Go for wattle seed extract. It's got a coffee chocolate hazelnut flavour, so it's a good substitute for vanilla.
And wattle seed has become quite popular over years. Can you actually meet demand?
No, we can't meet demand. I'm fielding phone calls all the time. I've got people looking for 2 or 3 tonnes, 500 kilos. And I probably only produce 500 kilos a year, so yeah, it falls well short of demand at the moment.
Are you looking at expanding your plantation?
Yes, we're going to put in another hectare. and we're going to remove some of the old trees and replace them. So we'll probably be doing a hectare and a half in the next 12 to 18 months.
And is wattle seed currently only supplied to the national market, or is there an international market opening up as well?
Yes, there is an international market opening up, not just for wattle seed, but for a lot of Australian native foods. I mean, it's regarded as spices and flavourings that the rest of the world haven't tried yet. You know, they've tried everything else. They've tried cinnamon and cocoa and whatever else is out there, but this is all new. So there is a demand, different flavours. Of course, the Aboriginal culture, their use, it's all coming into play. So the international interest is on the rise for sure.
And Mark, looking at production of wattle seeds and this year's growing conditions, what have they been like?
They've been pretty good, actually. With wattle trees, yeah, the hotter the better. They like a bit of stress. They seem to set seed heavier when they're under a bit of stress. So, as you know, we haven't had a lot of rain. We've had a lot of heat. So, yeah, it's been a pretty good crop this year.
Back when I was young, I always loved walking along the edge of the beach and seeing what you can find. I've always wanted to find message in a bottle. I haven't found one yet. Just picking up the stuff that's washed ashore has always intrigued me, and a lot of people love seeing what washes ashore, to pick it up and see what they can do with it.
For Pia Vachetti, a childhood interest in things that wash ashore has led to a unique environmental project that turns ocean debris into works of art. For the past few years, she's been organising a crew of volunteers to take part in a Clean Up Australia Day rubbish collection on an island off Western Australia.
Now, of course, there's so much plastic that's washing ashore, bottles and stuff like that, and I thought it'd be really great to do a Clean Up Australia Day and pick up the rubbish that's washed ashore. Flotsam and Jetsam was a really good name for it, because that's of things that get discarded by boats, or fishing gear that's gone astray, bits of ballast, bits of wood that are floating around the ocean, everything that washes ashore.
Hi, I'm Laura Meacham. I'm here with Pia Vachetti on Vasili Island, one of more than 100 islands that make up the Abrolhos Group, about 80 kilometres off the coast of Geraldton. For Pia, whose family has had a pearl farm here for generations, the annual rubbish collection is a way to give back to a special part of the world.
I've been coming here my whole life, so I'm emotionally attached to this place. But even when I bring workers over here that work on the pearl farm, they get attached to it as well. So it doesn't take much. Once people have visited the area, they just love the rawness of it and the way that it's kind of non-commercial. It's just very raw. There's no palm trees and often it's windy. Doing the Clean Up Australia Day and doing it up over here was my way of giving back from our business perspective as well. Like, at least we're cleaning up more than what damage we could be doing, because there's always something that's going to go a price to pay for using the waters here, and we want to minimise that effect as much as we can.
When it comes to this cleanup, what do you learn each year?
Well, the first year I brought 17 people out, and we did it in one day, and we could fill the 75-foot boat in one day. It wasn't really a problem. As time's gone by, like this trip, I've got 18 people and we've taken 2 days. Well, it's going to take 3 days to fill the boat to the same point. So in that respect, I feel that we've made a really big difference with the debris that's washed ashore. Like, we've been picking up ropes and floats that are really old, so that's getting less.
All the rubbish collected here finds its way back to the mainland, where much of it is turned into works of art.
Initially, it was just we were coming over to clean up the rubbish. And there was a reporter at the time that said to me, well, what are you going to do with all the rubbish? And I said, oh, I don't know, I'll probably just have to take it to the tip. And she says, oh, you should give it to the artists. That's a really, you know, then they can at least make something with it. And I was like, oh, that's a really good idea. How about we'll do that. Then they can, and I was just brainstorming when she was saying this. And I was like, well, we'll do that. Then they can take it away and then they can bring it back and we'll do an exhibition in the gallery. She was like, yeah, that's a good idea. So that's how we just rolled with it. We didn't know how good it was going to be. So it's kind of gotten bigger than what I'd imagined to begin with. We didn't expect to be doing it every year.
This year marks 400 years since Dutchman Frederik de Houtman discovered the Abrolhos. Chairman of the Maritime Heritage Association, Howard Gray, is writing a book on Houtman, and he joined the clean-up.
You know, all of us went out and had no trouble filling two or three bags, you know, in an hour or so of rubbish, and a lot of it's old pot rope, which lasts a long time. 400 years since the islands were first noted by Europeans, and, you know, in that time we've really had Europeans here, living here on and off since about the 1840s. You know, so it's a long period of time. Some really devastating impacts through guano mining, in particular on the islands. And so it is now, you know, this recognition that the environment is really, really so important. And, you know, keeping that as pristine as we can is part of our survival as well.
Another volunteer helping with the cleanup, Benjamin West, has been surprised by the amount of rubbish they've collected.
It's definitely a lot more than I expected, to be honest, and a lot of it just caught in the vegetation. And you know, we even saw some eagle nests that were just like an amalgamation of all the ropes and stuff. And it's kind of, I guess it's sad in a way to see what's there, but it's also really good to see that there's people that are going to go out there and help collect it and do something about it.
Cleanup organiser Pia Bichetti thinks the general public would be shocked to see just how much rubbish washes up on what would otherwise be pristine beaches.
I love it that we are making a big difference here, but it's quite sad when you see on a global basis the amount of plastics that are going into our ocean. Like if there's huge big orbs that are floating around in the Pacific Ocean. You hear about yachts that can actually land on these things. In places like Indonesia, rubbish just keeps washing up every day. Like they can clear probably five times as much a day as what I'm taking home from 3 days. So as long as, I suppose, we're looking after ourselves here and making sure that coming from a fishing industry, we want it to be sustainable. So there is going to be lost fishing gear. But if you want to eat seafood and if we want to feed everybody, there is going to be a small price to pay. So how about we just minimise the risk so much?
Pia Boschetti, who organised a rubbish clean-up on the Abrolhos Islands off Western Australia. Some of the debris collected will be recycled into artworks for an upcoming exhibition. That report from Laura Meacham. You're listening to A Big Country on RN. Still to come today, tips on brewing the perfect cuppa from award-winning tea producers, and the hunt for honey. Following the fake honey scandals, beekeepers are seeing increased demand for the real deal, and they're heading bush to bring home fresh, raw honey with a distinctive local flavour.
My favourite smell of everything in here is the freshly picked green leaf. There's just so much going on in there. The aromas and fragrances that come out of the fresh leaf is pretty amazing. It's like a combination of every nice perfume and flower along with the smell of a candy store. It's just so fresh and sweet. You stick your nose into a basket after a harvest and you're like, okay, yeah, it's going to be a good harvest.
Brendan Collins gets to enjoy this sweet aroma every day of the harvest. Along with his father, Daryl, he spends long days in this big, airy shed where they process the tea leaves grown on their property, Arakai Estate. Hi, I'm Jennifer Nichols, and I'm here with Brendan and Daryl Collins at their picturesque property at Belthorpe, high in the Sunshine Coast hinterland. Inside the big shed, tea leaves that have been harvested from the 5 kilometres of camellia bush on their property are rolled and dried to make award-winning black and green teas.
Today we're processing black tea. So at the moment we've got tea in the rollers. It'll go through the de-blocker. When it rolls, it comes out in tight little balls. So you break the balls up into individual leaves again.
So it's actually squashed?
Yeah, it curls the leaf and any stem gets crushed. Then it goes through the dryer twice. We've only got one dryer here, so we have to do two dryers, which takes a long time. And then that's the finished product.
Daryl Collins, you're saying that's a finished product. There's a lot of hours that go into that?
A lot of hours, yeah. I mean, I started at 5 this morning. It'll probably be midnight when I finish tonight.
Wow.
Mainly because of the dryer. We need a second dryer, really. It slows the process up. I mean, it'll take about 7 hours for that to dry. and it's got to go through twice. So there's a lot of hours. When the leaf comes in, it'll sit on the drop sheets on the floor for 2 or 3 hours, and it'll get turned a couple of times in that time. Then it gets put into the bamboo racks, and it's just the withering process. The leaf gradually starts to oxidise, and if we're making green tea, we'll turn that 2 or 3 times. We'll take the baskets down, turn it, put it back in the racks again. That changes the flavour of the green tea. Black tea isn't that important. We generally don't turn it with black tea. It just sits there, and then it goes into that oxidisation chamber, and that changes it from a green to a black. The difference is amazing. It goes from completely green to a copper colour in 2 hours in the oxidisation chamber. And that's running at 30 degrees C and 80% humidity.
What happens in the oxidisation?
I don't really know. Some sort of chemical process.
But you haven't added anything to it?
No, not a thing. We don't add anything to our tea at all.
So the green tea, does it go further than these bamboo racks then?
Yeah, the green tea will go from these bamboo racks through the steamer. We put about 10 kilos in for 6 minutes at 200-210 degrees C. And that stops it from oxidising. That makes a green tea. And then it goes through the roller, through the de-blocker, through the dryer.
So where did you learn your skills, given that you and Brendan only really took up green tea growing 8 or 9 years ago?
This sort of all happened a little bit by accident, this tea thing. But we did a tour through Taiwan for 10 days that we arranged through the Australian Tea Masters. And they organised a tour through 3 different processing methods in Taiwan with some of the smaller producers, which is certainly what we are. And they showed us what they did, how they did it, why they did it. And we sort of cherry-picked ideas from that.
And how proud are you that your tea from Belthorpe on the Sunshine Coast in the hinterland has been recognised with some of Australia's top tea awards?
Oh, it's fantastic. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't expected. We entered into the first competition and didn't even go to the awards night, not expecting to win anything. And then all of a sudden the phone's ringing and people are saying, oh, you've won all these awards. Well, I mean, we knew the tea was good, but it was an international competition. We didn't think we were going to win anything, you know. But yeah, it was really satisfying.
Yeah, so what we're aiming for with our end product is a really light and floral and naturally sweet tea. So something is going to be quite palatable to the average Australian. I think a lot of people have had a pretty bad introduction to green tea. I know when I first tried it, I thought it tasted like sticks and bugs. And a lot of that was just due to not knowing how to make it and probably just not knowing what a good tea is. So yeah, number one tip for green tea is don't use water above 90 degrees. That'll greatly improve a lot of people's green tea experience.
So how long do you have to leave the water to cool then after you boiled it?
Depends how you do it. We've got temperature controlled kettles here.
Of course you do.
But generally for people that don't, I just recommend boiling a litre and then adding a cupful of tap water, and that'll bring it down to around 90 degrees just as a simple measure.
I have had a bad green tea experience, so I'm quite interested to see how this goes.
So we weigh our tea first. I'm going to be doing a big jug here, so I'm going to use 15 grams of tea. And then to top it off, you time it. So this leaf is perfectly good for another couple of steeps. But if you leave the water sitting in there, it's just going to keep brewing and stewing. So what we recommend is that you do like multiple short steeps. So this just had a minute. The second steep would have a minute. Third steep, maybe a minute and a half. And then you just slowly increase from there. Whereas if you just keep it brewing, you'll just end up with a really bitter, strong cup of tea.
It's really showy at the ends, good rough bark. So now that it's drier weather, the bloodwood can be good for the bees and they can dry it out. But if we have a lot of rain, then they can't really bring the moisture content down. Fair bit of blue gum around here, but wrong time of the year for the blue gum.
Beekeeper Graham Thornton is driving his truck through familiar country on Queensland's Atherton Tableland. This trip, to check on about 120 hives near Ravenshoe, which is about 2 hours southwest of Cairns, has become a regular pilgrimage. As we get closer to the destination, it becomes clear that while Graham has one eye on the road, the other is fixed firmly on the tree line above us.
We spend most of the time looking up at the trees. You know, we're in the honey business, so we're trying to collect honey and looking for, you know, suitable trees. I mean, we've been out here and scoped this area out before. We know pretty much what's here, but it's the weather that then plays the different roles in, you know, showing us what's flowering and stuff. Big bloodwood flowering there. Stringy bark flowering just there now. It has been really wet. Last couple of times we were here, there's just kind of streams and rivers coming out the side of the mountain. It's really shaley territory here. So I'll just get her into four-wheel drive and go up the hill.
The truck pulls off the road and, well, this looks like we're just going up any old bush track. Doesn't look like much at all, but to beekeeper Graham, this site has enormous potential for his foraging bees.
Yeah, look, there was stringy bark starting to bud. Also, we know that the iron bark in January around this area can be quite promising. Although, you know, some years, and maybe one in 4 years, you'll get a eucalypt that'll flower, but it'll provide absolutely no sustenance or nectar for the bees. So, you know, you can have it in full flower and look at it and go, not a bee on it, and the bees just aren't interested. So some people say it's a mug's game, but wouldn't be dead for quids. I love coming out here and seeing the bees, and yeah, it's very interesting, it's very exciting every time we open up the boxes to see what's been going on.
You might want to put a jacket on straight away. See the kitten caboodle.
G'day, I'm Charlie McKillop, and I'm here with Graham and his offsiders, Kieran and Zach. We've pulled up at the top of the hill, and I can see the white hive boxes scattered in an area about the same size as an Olympic swimming pool. It's time to get suited up and take a closer look. Feels safe already.
Suited up already. Look just like a beekeeper. Yep, cool.
Pants on, shoes, glasses, hat. But I'm still going to need a hood?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely need a hood at all times. Bees are very feisty when you're robbing honey, so.
Well, I'm going to take your advice on that.
What we do when we first arrive at apiary is we get the smokers going. We then go along and put a small puff at the front of each hive. It just lets them know that we're here. It does a couple of things with the bees. It makes them go and gorge honey because they think that there's a bushfire coming naturally. So it gives them a full stomach. It makes them busy and kind of slows them down a little. It also calms the pheromones in the hive. So it masks the fright pheromone that they have. So if one bee decides that, you know, they're going to get angry, they'll let off a pheromone, which lets a whole lot of other bees know that they're angry as well. And then you won't have one come at you, you'll have hundreds come at you. So, you know, trying to mask that pheromone is very important. Yeah, and for your own safety.
Once they get started, the crew works quickly and methodically.
Ready to lift.
Each hive is checked and new supers or honey boxes are brought in to replace the full ones. The half full ones are rotated, so they now sit on top of the brood box. After all, as Graham explains, they're beekeepers, not robbers.
So then we can come out again next week. That box is like 3/4 full. We've undersupered it, so the bees will automatically continue to move the honey up. Quite a good flow on there, so they'll fill that box and we'll have another box of honey here ready next week.
When you talk about honey flow, what are you referring to?
So that's the nectar flow from the trees. And by just quite simply looking in the hive with that burr comb in the top and the fresh white wax, that pretty much tells us, you know, what's going on. I'll have a little taste and let you know what I think it is. That's Malloy box. Malloy red box. Delicious honey.
How discerning do you have to be able to pick up the variety of the tree that the bees have been foraging on?
Yeah, so you can, it has certain subtleties in the flavours. You know, so when we do pollination, the avocado honey is a lot darker. It's a really rich, smooth honey, and you can kind of tell even by the colours of the wax that the bees bring in. But yeah, that subtle flavours of the Malloy box, it really comes through.
Fire up this.
Beekeeper Graham Thornton there, tasting honey straight from the hive on Queensland's Atherton Tablelands. He was speaking with our reporter, Charlie McKillop. And that's the show for today. More information about all the stories you've heard can be found on our website, abc.net.au/radionational. You'll find A Big Country under the program tab.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.